before going to the physics, let me acknowledge Rob, who's not here. He'll come eventually. And Pablo Bueno, who did a lot of the heavy lifting. He's now a postdoc in Leuven. And a lot of work was motivated by discussions I had with Roger Malko and Miles and Meyer, who just left for California, and also Horacio Cassini. So this is the punchlines of the talk, essentially. So if it's boring, you know, you can fall asleep at this point. So I'm going to look at the geometry of entanglement in quantum systems, specifically in CFTs. And we'll be focusing on geometrical singularities, namely corners, in two spatial dimensions. And we'll see that this leads to a host of interesting properties for these CFTs. And the results will be generic for CFTs, irrespective of what they're built out of. And I'll focus on two dimensions spatially, but this connects to 1 plus 1 and 3 plus 1 as well. So if I have time, I'll try to make those connections. This is the hit list for today. So I'll briefly introduce why CFTs are relevant in condensed matter. Then I'll talk about the main part, which is the entanglement entropy in 2 plus 1 dimensions. Then we'll generalize this to Rennies. And finally, if I have time, I have one slide on Lifshitz theories, which are essentially cousins of CFTs, but with less symmetry. And I guess it was boring enough that she just shut it off. Okay. Yeah, I won't touch the computer again. All right, so why do we care about CFTs and condensed matter? It's because they're correlated quantum systems that appear naturally. They don't have any particle or quasi-particle, as we call them, excitations. And roughly, there's two types of CFTs or quantum critical systems. The first one is a quantum critical phase transition, and this requires fine-tuning some operator to reach this gapless point. And the other one is a gapless phase, and this does not require fine-tuning. And you can think of gauge theories, and this arises, for example, in some gapless spin liquids. But, you know, they're both CFTs, so this framework I'll be talking about describes both systems. Well, I mean, these could be both CFTs. So I'll be focusing on CFTs, which have, in condensed matter parlance, a dynamical exponent is equal to 1. And as I said, this will be mostly in 2 plus 1, which is the sort of most interesting dimension for us to work in. So this is my favorite CFT. I always show this slide. I'm trying to find another one, but I always come back to this one because it's so intuitive. So this is a Hamiltonian lattice and a square lattice where I have two terms that don't commute. So this is a setup for a quantum critical phase transition. The first term hops boson with amplitude T, which is real. The second term wants to prevent hopping by having a repulsion on each site. And here I'm going to work at, for example, a filling of 1 boson per site on average. So it's well known that this is a ground state phase diagram, and there's a quantum phase transition that goes from the insulator that happens at very small tunneling amplitude to the superfluid that happens when the tunneling amplitude exceeds a critical value. And this quantum phase transition is continuous, and in fact, you can argue very strongly that it's a CFT. So it has emergent Lorentz invariance and emergent conformal invariance. So that's very nice. And you know, things go weird as you approach this critical point. For example, if you look at a superfluid density in this phase and you approach this critical value of T over U, you find that the density vanishes as a power law. And the power is beta here, and it's a universal number that characterizes this quantum critical point or this CFT. And this describes many different Hamiltonians. That's one example. But if you take models of XY spins, Josephson junctions, ultracold atoms, which really is this, you'll get the same lineage of physics. And you can also go beyond and look at more exotic CFTs or critical points. For example, you can look at O2 star, which is essentially a gauged version of this thing, where you have these bosons. But instead of going from a superfluid to a normal insulator, you go into a fractionalized insulator. And you have some emergent gauge field that appears at a critical point and remains in the gap phase. But they're sort of nearly related to each other. In terms of field theory, it's pretty simple. This transition is described by our good old phi-4 field theory, where phi is a complex boson. You tune R to 0, you get a critical point. When R is negative, you break the U1 symmetry or O2 symmetry spontaneously. the problem for theorists is that U is relevant, so it grows in EIR. So you flow to this strong interacting fixed point. You know, it's not dramatic for this case, but it's still interacting. And that's often called the Wilson-Fisher CFT. If I only had one component here, this would be the Ising CFT. And this theory has no quasi-particles in a sense that there's no poles in the fundamental Green's functions. So it's as correlated as we want. And the goal is to describe properties of, for example, this critical point, which we'll meet again in a talk when I'll show some simulations by Roger Malko and friends. And the cool thing is that this transition, or at least a cartoon of it, was realized a few years ago, I guess now 11 years ago, by Emmanuel Bloch and company, where they load atoms in an optical lattice. This is, again, this is in two dimensions, just as I talked before. And as you change the potential depth of your optical lattice, you go from an insulator to a superfluid, where here I'm showing the velocity distribution once you release a trap. So here you have this crazy peak that appears because you have Bose-Einstein condensation. And this is showing some energy scales that vanish as you approach the critical value of essentially this T over U. So this should be the CFT point, but you know, it's a finite size problems in this system, so we're not really probing the full CFT, but hopefully this becomes more quantitative in the coming years, but it's already a very good start. So after this motivation, let me just jump into the physics, which will be about entanglement and about corners in two dimensions. So why entanglement? That's a slide I feel I have to put on as a kinetic matter physicist. You'll see why. So it's a defining property of the quantum world, so of course we should care. But it's not a natural thing to compute many times. So even if you take simple systems, like the system I talked about, or even the free version of that system, if you ask many questions about entanglement, the way to get them is actually pretty hard. And you can ask Max and Sabir about this. They have some pretty massive papers on that. So there's that. But in recent times, theorists have thought about this a lot. And we have much more analytical control on how to compute this in different systems. And also numerics is improving. Bigger computers, better algorithms. So that's two reasons why we're seeing more and more entanglement studies these days. More fundamentally, entanglement actually is useful as an order parameter for certain phase transition or phases, especially if you go beyond the Landau symmetry breaking paradigm, where you don't break a symmetry like I just talked about in this O2 Wilson-Fisher fixed point. There, you can't use an order parameter. Really, so entanglement turns out can serve as your order parameter. This can tell you, look, you have some topology in this vacuum. And this is many works by these people, but I think these four people had a lot of the initial impetus in that direction. Experiments is hard. So that's why, you know, we shouldn't be too enthusiastic about entanglement and kinetic matter, but you know, people are trying to find new ways to measure it indirectly or almost directly. This is a paper from the Harvard group, so Marcus Greiner and company. They're looking at essentially what I talked about, cold atoms in a lattice. So this is like essentially two 1D systems of atoms. And in this work, they're measuring the second Rennie entropy of that chain of atoms as you go from an insulator into a superfluid or a quasi-superfluid. It's small system sizes, so you know you can't take everything seriously, but it's a pretty neat way to directly measure the Rennie entropies. So this just appeared in Nature a few months ago. So I expect to see more studies very soon. All right, so let's define the players. A lot of you probably know this. So this is the main player of the talk, S, the entanglement entropy. So the game is that I choose a region V in blue. And so I have a ground state first. Then I choose a region V, and I define the reduced density matrix rho V as what happens as you take the density matrix for the ground state and you trace out everything that's outside the blue region. So you remove all the gray region and you're left with a reduced density matrix that describes what happens inside V. And this now is a mixed matrix, and this is an entropy, which often is called a von Neumann entropy. It's minus trace of rho log rho, and that's what we call the entanglement entropy. So roughly what it does, it counts how much entanglement you have between the inside and the outside of your region V. And in fact, it's very useful to do counting in quantum critical systems. This is idea of Rob Myers, where they propose that if you look at a region V, which is a disk like this, then this is the entropy. So L is the size of your disk, delta is a UV scale, so your lattice spacing or your UV cutoff. That's the area law term, scales with the perimeter of the region. So that's interesting, but B is not universal. You can sort of redefine how you have your delta, and this will alter your B. But F isn't. No, there's some caveats, but if you do it sort of carefully enough, this is universal quantity, and it's negative. And this thing was argued by Rob that this should decrease under RG flow. So if you have two CFTs that are related from RG, you flow from A to B, then F at A is greater than F at B. Okay, so this counts your absolute degrees of freedom in the context of relativistic theories. This was proven by Cassini-Huerta not too long ago. So F is really the analog of little c, the zero simple charge in 1 plus 1 dimension. And that's called the F theorem, the fact that this F decreases under RG. So it's a cool quantity, which was recently discovered. And it would be nice to have this number for generic systems. And by generic, I mean often on the lattice, because these are coupled Hamiltonians, so field theory sometimes is quite difficult. But the problem is that on a lattice, you can't avoid corners. Obviously, there's a caveat. If you work on a cylinder on a torus, you can. And there's some nice work by Max and company and Subir, where they look at cylinders. But say you work on a flat, on a planar region, then you always have corners. For example, in a square lattice, you have these pi by 2 corners. And the question is, you know, what's their contribution to entanglement? Do they spoil this nice F we're looking after? And you probably know the answer from my title. The answer is yes. So let me explain you why. So let's take our disk and deform it to make this corner region with a beak there, opening angle theta. And now we have, again, the entropy, which counts entanglement between inside and outside. We have the area law term, or the perimeter term. And we want this guy, the constant. But in fact, this is sort of spoiled by this logarithm, which diverges as this linear size L diverges. And now if I sort of redefine delta to be 2 delta, this will spoil it constant. So this constant becomes non-universal. So F is hidden, essentially, or it's sort of shielded by this logarithm. But this log in itself is interesting, because if you just look at this, you notice that this prefactor is universal, because if you change how you define L or delta, this doesn't pollute the prefactor A of theta, which I'm going to call the corner function or corner coefficient. So A doesn't depend on a regulator you choose. So you can compute it different ways, from a lattice, from field theory. You can guess it. And it should all agree, assuming you're very smart. So let's look at some properties of A to see if it's a cool quantity to look at. So it's positive, so this thing is negative. This was proven by Cassini-Huerta. And the other basic thing is that it has this property. It's reflection symmetric about pi. So A of theta is equal to A of 2 pi minus theta. And this is because we're dealing with a ground state of your CFT. It's a pure state. So the entanglement entropy of the inside and the outside are equal. And the outside angle is 2 pi minus theta. So all the plots I'm going to show only go from 0 to pi, because the other one is symmetric about pi. OK, so now let's see what this thing is trying to probe more physically. So the claim here is that it only probes the gapless modes of your quantum critical theory, or your CFT. So TQFTs, which are CFTs, this thing will be 0, at least generically, because they don't have any gapless modes. And the heuristic is that in your gapless CFT, these massless modes essentially sort of permeate all of space and can probe the geometry and really feel this corner. Whereas if you have a gap system, you don't have that. And this log is effectively cut off. And this is the back of the envelope argument that sort of shows you why this is true. This is from Brian, but I'm sure like there's many variants of this. So the idea is to compute S by looking at the entanglement coming from every scale R in your theory. So as a warm-up, you can just look at trying to reproduce the perimeter law for the entropy. And here, what we say is that at each scale R, you get essentially L over R entanglement contributions to S. And the measure is the R over R because it has to be dimensionless. Okay? And now you integrate from scales from the UV delta up to a certain scale Xi, which could be L if your system is gapless, or if it's a gap system, Xi is a finite number that does not diverge with your subsystem size. And the answer you get, respective of what Xi is the perimeter law. So that works. If you look at how much corners contribute, you do essentially the same thing, but you take this to the power 0 because a corner is a point. So you integrate 1 from delta to Xi with this measure, and you have a log. And this log is log of Xi over delta. So if Xi is finite in a gap system, this does not diverge with your subsystem size, and you don't have this. In a CFT, which is gapless, this will go as L, and you recover that term. And this also explains why you have a log in 1 plus 1 dimension, because the endpoints of an interval are points. So this argument catches this. There's caveats, doesn't really work for cones in 3 plus 1D, but for this case, it's good enough. So let's talk a bit about 1 plus 1 dimensions, where people are very familiar with this result from Vilcek and company. So let's look at the entanglement entropy of an interval of length L. And this is a classic answer. It's twice C over 6, where C is your universal central charge. So that's another log. So this thing is universal in front. And I'm going to argue that you can think of these endpoints at the interval as two corners, quote unquote. This seems very loose. You'll see that there's indeed a bit more of a connection. And this, well, okay, so for example, if you look at half a semi-infinite interval, you find that the answer is half of what you have for an interval. So in this case, you only have one endpoint in your interval. So it really tells you that what contributes to this first term in the entropy is really the intervals, the endpoints of the interval. And that's one loose interpretation of why you have an area law violation in one spatial dimension. Because if you naively guess, you guess that this should be a constant, because the length of the boundary of V is zero. But in fact, you have this log, and I'm going to sort of argue that this is because these are special points, corners, quote unquote. So let's go back to 2D and see this connection flourish a bit. So I'm going to argue that A is a good measure of gapless degrees of freedom. So first thing to check is free fields. You take n free bosons. You find that A is n times that of a single boson. And that's a non-trivial function, actually, which is computed by Cassini-Horta. But nonetheless, it has this additive property, which you expect for free fields. Then you go look at sort of more complex theories, which are very strongly coupled. These are large n CFTs. And there you find that A of theta scales as n to the 3 halves, which is the number you expect to get for those large n superconformal field theories. And this is using Ryutaka and Nagi. So in these two extremes, you get the right counting in some sense. And you also get sort of the right counting, quote unquote, if you do numerics at small n in these Wilson-Fisher fixed points I talked about in the beginning. And that we'll see in a few slides. So the simplest part, yeah.
Is the back of the envelope calculation value you decided negative?
Doesn't right now. At least not naively. Yeah, that's a good point.
If the back of the envelope calculation told you that the sign would be negative.
Yeah. I mean, if you're maybe clever about this, you can see the negative sign, but in this loose presentation I did, it doesn't come out. Yeah. That's why it's a loose argument. So let's look at this corner function of coefficient, the limit that's simplest, meaning that you almost have no corner. So theta is almost equal to pi. And then in that case, it turns out that this corner function vanishes, of course, because when theta is pi, there's no angle, there's no corner. And the vanishing is quadratic, so the function is actually analytic around that theta equal to pi point. And you have a number in front, which we call sigma, and that's a universal number that describes your CFT, or the gapless degrees of freedom of your CFT. Okay, so the question is, what is sigma? What's sigma telling you about your theory? That's the sort of baby question we can start with. This is a conjecture we made with Rob and Pablo, is that sigma is exactly given by CT, times a number we don't care about. And what is CT? CT is given by the two-point function of the stress tensor of your CFT. So TT at different spacetime points x is CT over x to the 6. Everything's a power law in the vacuum of your CFT. And that's some tensor structure, which doesn't matter. So more concretely, if you set all these indices to 0, it tells you how the energy density, the quantum energy density, correlates at different spatial points in your theory. So it's a very fundamental quantity in any quantum critical point. Okay, so this sigma is this stress tensor coefficient. And this is kind of special because entanglement, this S, when you compute it, usually gives you non-local properties of your theory. But in this smooth limit, it reduces to a local observable quantity, CT. So now I'm going to argue for why this conjecture is true. And in fact, I'm going to show you a proof, not by me. And this to make a connection with 1 plus 1D CFTs, if you recall in 1 plus 1D, in fact, the CT, this number here, is exactly given by the little c. So in that case, this log also is determined by CT. So that's one more connection between this corner in 2 plus 1 dimensions and the log interval result in 1 plus 1 dimension. We'll see something a bit more deeper for the Rennie case. So let's play around with theories and see if it holds. First thing you do is look at free theories. You have two free theories in 2 plus 1D, free boson, free fermion. We use some pioneering work by Cassini and Horta to do numerical checks of this. So you know CT exactly for those theories, and numerically we got sigma using Cassini, and we found that this exactly agrees with the conjecture. And then Henriette Elvang and her student Marios Hadjiantonis came up with a pretty impressive proof for the free fields. So this holds exactly for the free fields. Now, in the opposite limit of strong coupling, you can look at ADS CFT because we have this beautiful expression from Shinsei Ryu and Takayanagi. So we looked at a family of holographic CFTs. It's a bulk action of these theories. I'm not really telling you what these terms are. But you have two parameters, lambda 1, lambda 2. And we looked at this ratio of sigma over CT as a function of lambda 1 over lambda 2. And we found that these theories, as you vary these couplings, this ratio always remains the same, namely pi squared over 24. So that was sort of encouraging evidence for this conjecture. And then Rob and Pablo, and independently Rongxing Miao, came up with a proof of this fact in pretty generic class of holographic CFTs. So now this holds at weak coupling and strong coupling in between, we didn't really know. And this is where the paper by Tom Faulkner, Rob Lee, and Ankar Parikar came November 16th. And they proved this for generic theories. Let me just tell you what happens there. So you start with the half planar region V. You trace the outside. But in this case, you want to deform the boundary by a small bump, and the bump function, let's call it zeta of x. So the entanglement entropy varies as follows for small zeta. This is the zeroth order term, first order, and it turns out this is the term you want. And this is often called the entanglement density. So what Tom and company showed is that this entanglement density, or kernel, is exactly given by this power law. So it's minus pi squared CT over 4 times this power, which is essentially fixed by dimension. Okay, so this was the main result, which is more generic than just this corner term. But if you take this region, this bump, to have two corners, one on the left side and one on the right side, you recover our result. And this was done for generic CFTs. So this proves that this is indeed the case for generic conformal field theories. in two dimensions, spatial dimensions. So maybe it's not super intuitive, but it's not super obvious proof, so I won't go much into detail about this result, but you can take this as the theorem. So smooth limit is fine, but it's not what we want really. We want finite angles, because it turns out numerics happens at finite angles. And this is where we're going to look at what can we say about finite angles just from very basic properties of quantum mechanics and conformal field theory. So there's this very important identity for entanglement entropy that was shown in the 70s. It's quite non-trivial, actually. It says that for two regions, V and V prime, the sum of the entropy for V and V prime exceeds or is equal to the sum of the union plus that of the intersection. And that's called strong subadditivity of entanglement, or SSA for short. So Cassini and company showed that this property for corners, you take V and V prime to be two corners with different angles, that this implies a differential inequality for this function AF theta. So differential in respect to the theta. So you take derivatives with respect to the opening angle. So in a paper with Pablo, what we recently showed is that if you take this inequality for A of theta and this exact result for the smooth limit coefficient, you can essentially integrate this ODE and get this exact lower bound valid for any CFD. So not only is this positive, but this has to exceed this function of the opening angle, which is very simple. And CT appears here, obviously, because we use as input what happens in a smooth limit as the boundary condition to integrate to finite angles. So if you compute A of theta for any CFT, if it violates this bound, your answer is wrong. So this is our bound in action, essentially. So here I'm plotting A of theta normalized by this important number, CT, divided by the opening angle and not divided by, versus the opening angle theta. So theta equal to pi is a smooth limit. This has to vanish for any theory. The bound also vanishes. That's a bound in dashed orange. So you're not allowed to be in this region. You have to be above this entanglement threshold. And then let's put some CFTs on this plot. So I'm going to put the two free field theories, free scalar, free Dirac fermion, blue and red. They're somewhere in there. And the gray line is from holography, a pure Einstein bulk. So this corresponds to a superconformal field theory. If I didn't normalize by CT here, this gray line would be vertical, because CT is infinite for that theory, essentially. So the fact that all these things collapse into almost the same curve is quite non-trivial, because they're very different quantities. Whereas, you know, A for the scale and the fermion are order one numbers, like 0.5 or something. And now what's more interesting is that these are sort of generic finite n CFTs, and this is from Roger Malko and company. We have the Olin Wilson-Fischer fixed points for n equal 1, that's the Ising CFT. For n equal 2, it's the XY one, which I just talked about. And n equal 3, we call that the Heisenberg critical point. And they have square lattice simulation, so the angle they get is pi over 2, because that's the most natural angle they have. And if you put these three CFTs on this plot, they're exactly on top of each other within error bars. And they lie on top of essentially the other lines. So I should say, like, these lines are not the same, but they're almost the same. And it's not clear why it's the case. What you really want in this plot is an upper bound, which sandwiches these lines to be almost on the same line. And the conjecture I'm going to make here is that the upper bound perhaps is the blue line, the free scalar. But no one knows. Probably. Because it's not doing well here, actually. Yeah, so that's a good question. Can you improve this lower bound? I'm sure you can. Because, you know, these theories don't deviate so much at small angles. So that's cool. Or if someone comes up with a CFT, which just goes crazy and follows the lower bound a bit more. But I don't think it'll happen.
So are there any even estimates of what the divergence is at theta approaching zero?
Oh, yeah. So it's exactly 1 over theta. There's a pole at the origin. So all these blue, gray, and red lines go as 1 over theta at small theta. And the line only goes as log theta. So that's a mismatch. So the bound is too weak at small angles. But it's very good at large angles. And I'm going to use that to explain some results from Monte Carlo. This is what I just said. The bound is almost saturated for angles between pi over 2 and pi, right? It's the same curve, essentially. So here comes Monte Carlo. This is a result that got me to this field or this topic because I was puzzled by what Roger was finding. So here at PI over lunch, he just put this on the table. I'm doing simulations for the ON model by I. It's Roger speaking. So this is the ON model, and he's looking at n equal 1, 2, 3. And he finds this relation that relates all of them. So remember, square lattice, we're doing pi over 2 angles. So what Roger found is that for n equal 2 and 3, the value he finds for pi over 2 is only n times that of Ising, namely n equal 1. So this seems to scale with n at small n. And that's kind of crazy, because there's no reason why things should scale with n at small n in those theories. At large n, of course, it will, because n is large. But when n is small, there's no reason why this should happen. And this quickly is because it's within error bars. So, but you know, Raj was confident with data, so he's like, yeah, that's the result. And I was like, OK, what's happening here? Is this exact? You know, is this equal? That was one of the questions. And we're going to use the fact that this A at pi over 2 is essentially controlled by CT. So you can think of this as CT times a number, which is the same for all CFDs from this previous plot. And now comes Bootstrap at just the right time. So Bootstrap computed CT for the ON CFDs at small n. And they have these extremely precise results. And they find that this relation holds analogously for CT. So CT for the ON model goes as n times Ising for n equal 2, 3, and even 4. And how good is it? So for n equal 2, it's point, the ratio of O2 to twice Ising is 0.99688, error bar on the last digit. So this combined with this explains this result, essentially. Yeah, Max?
What about CT Ising on the CT3? Is that also very close to 1?
Or? Yeah, so this is 0.9 or 9.5. It's between 9 and 9.5, 0.9 and 0.95. So it's pretty close.
Yeah. I think it's even closer, maybe. I think it's really close, a few percent.
So 0.95, I think, roughly. Yeah, it's in the Bootstrap paper. It's pretty close. So these are like not fully correlated CFDs in some sense. You know, they're kind of close to the free theory. And you know, so this kind of explains why Roger sees this scaling. And the prediction here is that if you were able to do this much more precisely, you would find small deviations from this relation. There's no reason why this should hold, in fact. It's just that, you know, the accuracy we have and this fact combined to this relation, this emergent effective relation at small n.
Is the expectation that it's small greater than deviate much more based on the solution?
Yeah. Not huge amount, I think, but more, yeah. Because remember that like all these curves are pretty close. And so I'm going to argue that the scalar is the upper bound. And I'm going to argue that the Ising CFT is above holography. Holography is like a lower bound. It's often the case. If that's true, then you know there is some wiggle room at small theta, but it's not a lot. And I'm pretty sure that will happen. We don't have data at small angles, but in the future it might happen. But yeah, that's a good question. It's a good point. Check this relation, different angles. All right, so now let's switch gears and talk about something more interesting, or slightly more interesting. It's the Rennie entropies. So now I'm going to look at not trace of rho log rho, but trace of rho to the n. And n is called a Rennie index. It's like some effective temperature you define to probe your ground state or vacuum the CFD. And there, things are much more interesting, it turns out. So the whole thing about corners and logarithms follows through just with putting subscripts n everywhere. So there's a corner coefficient that comes with a log. And we want to study what happens to this corner coefficient as you vary this Rennie index n. I should say when n goes to 1, assuming everything is well behaved, you recover the von Neumann entropy we talked about in the previous part. So a special limit, you get back part one of the talk. And the motivation is that, you know, what new physics happen as you vary n, but also we have numerics, or Roger has numerics, that look at these Wilson-Fischer CFTs but as a function of the Rennie index. Okay, so that's A at pi over 2, but I'm varying the Rennie index here, n. So you have this curve. So the green one is for xy. The red dashed one is below it, and that's for quantum criticalizing. Okay, so I'm going to just review briefly how to compute the Rennie entropies. It's going to be useful to describe objects that appear, like twist operators and so forth. So the basic thing we have to have is a density matrix for a region V. It's not a matrix, really, because it's in a continuum. We're doing field theory. So these indices are field configurations on your region V. I'm going to call them phi plus and phi minus. Just to picture this in 1 plus 1D, this is space. This is time that goes into the board. You have your interval V. And you need a path integral for this field theory, imposing boundary conditions at time t0 minus to be phi minus, at time t0 plus to be phi plus. And that gives you your reduced density matrix rho of v. Okay? To get the Rennie entropy, for example, S2, we want to have trace of rho squared. That's the purity of the quantum state. So we need something that produces matrix multiplication of this density matrix. And there's a very nice trick, which is called the replica trick, where you replicate your space-time geometry to have two copies. And this space-time is essentially matrix multiplication. So you have two copies of a space-time, space-time 1, sheet number 2, again, t into the board, x parallel to it. And this yellow crap is really, it's just like branch cuts. So it's not part of the surface. It's not like, it's not there, really. It's just there to, as a mnemonic trick. So we want to implement trace of rho v squared. So we have two density matrices, rho v with phi and with phi prime. That's phi, that's phi prime. And we want to link, we want to have phi plus to be equal to phi prime minus. So phi plus is here. And this connects to phi prime minus. And we want to have phi minus equal to phi prime plus. So phi minus is this one. It goes around. And it goes to phi prime plus. So this space-time really implements rho squared. So nothing deep happening here, actually. And what's special is that, so these are branch cuts in your two-sheeted space-time. And if you go around a branch cut, so you start here, you try to go here, whoop, you take an elevator, and you end up on the other sheet. So these are branch points in this special geometry. They take you from one space-time to the other. A more convenient way to talk about this is to not talk about two copies of a space-time, but one space-time with two copies of your theory. Okay, so I'm going to have single space-time, as usual, but take two copies of my field theory. So all the fields will have now a new index, A, which runs from 1 to 2, because I'm doing only second Rennie just for this example. Same thing. And in this case, what happens is that to compute the trace of rho squared, you want to insert twist operators at the boundary of your entangling region. So for a single interval, the boundary is two points, x1 and x2. You put branch points, or you put twist operators, I'm sorry, tau at x1, tau at x2. The subscript 2 tells you you're doing the second Rennie entropy. And as you go around this operator, your field index goes from 1 to 2. This exactly implements this yellow elevator we had here. So you go around this one, you go from phi 1 to phi 2. So in 1D, it's simple. Twists are points. Local operators are even primaries in a CFT. In 2 plus 1D, things are a bit more complicated because now the boundary of your region is a line. So if it's a region which is a half plane, the simplest case, your boundary is a line, a straight line. And so your twist operator is a line operator now. It lives on this line. So as you go around in space-time, so you go around out of the board, which is a time direction, and you sort of go around this line, your field index will change. Okay, so that's what the twist does. And to compute trace of rho to the n, you insert a twist operator with Rennie index n, and you evaluate that in the n-copied state you have. So you take your vacuum, you make n copies of it, and you take this average. So these are twist operators, and these will play an important role in this corner entanglement business. It's not obvious why, but hopefully it'll become more obvious. And for you, for people who sort of do numerics and work with quantum Monte Carlo, for example, you might be familiar with swap operators. So for a swap is defined as the thing that gives you the purity if you have Rainy index 2, and that's exactly what a twist operator gives you. So the point here is that the twist really is a swap operator, but in fact, more precisely, the twist operator defines the boundary of the swap operator, which is all you need to know. So if you look at for an interval, you have two states. They're not coupled, they're entangled, and the region V is these three sites. This is the outside when it traces out. If you apply swap to this state, this product state, you entangle, you swap essentially these two parts, but keep these one identical. So now you entangled, you know, system two with system one, and vice versa, as follows here. And the twist would tell you that, you know, you insert a twist operator here at the boundary, and it would tell you that you essentially start swapping as you go left of the twist. So you should really think of a twist operator as a swap operator. So I'm going to use the word twist for now, but you can think of swap operators if you want. So the most important number that you want to define for an operator is the dimension. We have a scaling, we have a CFT, so we want to talk about the conformal dimension of this twist operator, and we call that h sub n, n is the Rainy index. So the way it's defined is you take a half planar region, V, so the twist is a line, a straight line, and to compute the dimension, you insert a stress tensor, a distance y from this line, outside the region. This result is essentially by symmetry. It's the twist dimension over y cubed times a tensor structure, which is not important here. So this spits out the twist dimension. That's how it's defined. If you have a general smooth surface, like a disk or an ellipse, you could just zoom enough closely enough that you have a straight line. In 1 plus 1D, some of you might notice relations. So twist operators are primary operators, and their scaling dimensions are actually fixed in closed form. It's C over 12 times n minus n inverse. So this is a result by Vilcek and company, and you can check this review by Cardi. So that's a result for twist operators in 1 plus 1D, where they're actually points, so things are simpler. And there, if we go back and look at the Rainy entropies of intervals in 1 plus 1D, what do we have there? So we have a log again, and this term now depends on the Rainy index, and I write that twice, delta, sigma n twice, because you have two endpoints. And sigma n is given by the twist dimension over n minus 1. So one question that we had is that, you know, what's the connection between corner entanglement in 2 plus 1D and this twist dimension that appears naturally in the log in 1 plus 1D? Because they're both logs, corners, quote unquote, in 1 plus 1D. Is there a connection? And yes, there is. So if you look at the smooth limit of the corner function again, the simplest limit, theta almost pi, this again vanishes quadratically with deviations from pi. And now the sigma acquires a Rainy index dependence, sigma n. So when sigma was 1, when n was 1, this was equal to Ct. And the question is, what happens when n is not equal to 1? And this is a relation that we conjecture. So this is the more important equation, the most important equation in this talk, I guess. It tells you that the smooth limit coefficient of corners is the twist dimension over n minus 1 and times this 1 over pi. So this is exactly what we found for 1 plus 1d log for an interval. Can we check this? In some cases, it turns out yes. So if you look at n near 1, we should recover the proof of Tom and company. And we're going to use a result from Rob, Janet, Misha, and Yale. So when n is near 1, you can expand this hn, because you can compute hn from CFT methods. And that's what Rob proved in general for any CFT. It's pi cubed Ct over 24 times n minus 1. So as n goes to 1, you plug that in here. The n minus 1 vanishes, is canceled by the denominator. This pi is killed, and you recover pi squared Ct over 24. So it's a very non-trivial check of this relation as n goes to 1, as it should. So, you know, you can think of the sigma n as some sort of like higher dimensional analog of the 1 plus 1D CFT interval entropy coefficient, at least I like to think of it that way. Okay, so this is a slide on how to compute HN. You can draw a nice plot, hyperbolic space. I won't go into this. If you have questions, please ask me at the end of the talk. You can essentially evaluate some energy in a curved spacetime. So let's check this conjecture. For some theories, again, free theories come to the rescue. So Henriette Elvang and her student got sigma n for all n. But you cannot, it's not a closed form, so you have to look at case by case. And Rob tells me what HN is from his papers. So let's compare these quantities and see if this relation holds. So we did this up to n equal to 500. These are the six first entries. Free boson, free fermion, they're irrational numbers. You know, nothing transparent. But if you compute HN and take the ratio, you find that this is exactly true for the free theories. So for all n up to 500. It's not a proof, but it's a pretty good check. And then Stuart Docker, who's a quantum gravity specialist, comes along and proves this both for the free boson and the free fermion. So this relation in the corner here, this was mentioned giving the smooth coefficient, is true for the free field theories. We also found this interesting duality between the boson and the fermion. So if you look at the boson smooth coefficient at 1 over n, so n is integer, so 1 half, 1 third, 1 fifth, this is exactly equal to n squared times the fermion 1, but not for 1 over n, but for n. And this we actually proved ourselves. So we did one proof at least. And that's kind of, you know, puzzling. And Roger and company, Anusha and friends are, Lauren, are looking at this relation, whether this duality is true at finite angles, so away from the smooth limit, away from theta near pi. And things look like it's pretty close, so, to be followed. This is our plot for this smooth limit coefficient sigma n versus n I divided by ct, because we need something to divide by. And here I'm plotting the free boson and free fermion. Again, blue is boson, red is fermion. And the green dashed line is from pure Einstein. So it's holographic CFTs. And this is a prediction we have, because no one computed this sigma n in ADS CFT, because Ryu Takanagi only works for von Neumann case, so n equal 1. But people with recent results have ideas about n not equal to 1. So in principle, I think this could be checked in the near future for at least this holographic CFT, which is a strong coupling. So it's the opposite limit of the red and blue lines. But what's crazy is that the free fermion and holography have almost the same dependence on the Rennie index. And it's very good when the Rennie index is below 1. It's here you can see deviations, but here it's really hard to see them. And that's, we don't understand why. I mean, they're very different theories. And this turns out diverges. This is a log-log plot, by the way. This diverges as 1 over n squared. And let's look at why this is the case and what this tells you about the CFT, because it turns out it's actually interesting. So let's look at this sigma n, this smooth limit coefficient, as n goes to 0. Using our conjecture, you can find this result. So it's given by CS over n squared. So it blows up as n goes to 0. And what is CS? So CS is the thermal entropy density coefficient of your full CFT. Take your CFT, heat it up at fine temperature. The entropy density is given by T squared. And CS is a universal number that's positive that tells you how much thermal entropy your degrees of freedom give you. And this CS is what appears in this corner coefficient as n goes to 0. And so there's a similarity between these two formulas, because you can think of the Rennie index as 1 over temperature. Because you're doing, remember, we're doing here rho to the n. And this is some modular Hamiltonian e to the minus h tilde times n. So n, you can write like this. It's like some inverse temperature. So when n is very, very small, this temperature is very, very large, and you're probing all your states, things look thermal, and that's the loose reason why you recover this thermal entropy density in that limit. So it's 1 over n squared and it's t squared. The powers also match. And the take-home message, at least for me, was that the ground state really knows much more than I would expect. So you give me, you do a simulation of, say, Bose Hubbard model and a square lattice, you give me the ground state, no Hamiltonian, no Lagrangian, nothing. I compute this corner coefficient, and as n goes to zero, I can tell you what's the full thermal entropy density of your CFD, which includes a continuum of excited states. So it's a pretty neat way to get at this number. Although I think in practice, computing this from an actual ground state wave function might be very difficult because, so Roger has some results about anomalous scaling for the Rennie entropies as you do finite size simulations. And it seems that it might be quite hard to get this practically, numerically. But in principle, this is the result. So at least in principle, the ground state knows a lot. So I should put in principle here. Because I don't think we'll see this result coming out soon. But let's see, maybe. So that's one recipe to get the full thermal entropy from your ground state. And this paper came out November 20th. Remember, the other paper was November 16th. So this is a paper by Marco, Rob Myers, Misha Smolkin, and Lorenzo Bianchi. And they're going towards the generic proof of the sigma n being equal to the twist dimension. In fact, they were going for the proof for the n equal 1 case, but somehow got a bit scooped by Tom there. It's quite non-trivial proof, actually, so you know, I don't blame them. So they look at, essentially, I'm going to rephrase this in the language of Tom's paper. You look at a bump on a plane. Again, bump function zeta is very small. It's a perturbation. The entropy has a first variation and a second variation. And here I forgot the zeroth order. Oh, no, this is delta. Phew. So this is, again, your sort of Rennie entropy density. And this is what they find as a main result for this quantity. So they show that this quantity is given by the two-point function of what they call defect operators. So these are defect operator at x and x prime, and you have inserted the twist operator because you're computing the Rennie entropies. So defect operators effectively shift your region from a straight line to a bump. So they shift your entangling surface transverse to it. And by symmetry, this is what they find, is that it's, again, x minus x prime to the fourth power. And there's a numerator, which depends on the Rennie index. So when n is equal to 1, this goes back to Tom's proof. When n is generic, we don't really know. So the paper didn't go as far as saying this. Or, I mean, they conjectured this, but there's no proof of this statement that we expect that the Cn really is equal to the twist dimension times a bunch of pi's and stuff like that. But that's, you know, an important first step towards the proof of this corner result and a more generic result for this Rennie entropy density. And hopefully there'll be a proof next week, Rob, or yeah. So if this is true, you just put a bump with two corners on each side and you can derive our conjecture as a special case. So if anyone's curious, just try it. Oh, I have time for Lifshitz. Amazing. All right, so not CFTs for once, because CFTs are very cool, but there's more. Oh, man. Okay. Jesus. Okay, phew. So Lifshitz theories are theories which have z not equal to 1. You don't have Lorentz invariants, but you have scale invariants. There's a very special class of Lifshitz theories which have z equal to 2. And these are very special because their equal time correlation functions are given by a parent lower dimensional CFT, so a 2 plus 0 of these CFT. So the spatial correlation functions have the full conformal symmetry of 2 plus 1 d theories, 2 plus 0 theories. That's the simplest example you can think of. It's a parent of a free boson, but instead of having grad squared, you have grad squared squared. So you have two time derivatives, four space ones. That's why z is 2, because for each time, you have two spaces. Two spaces. Two x's. So in that case, Eduardo Fratkin and Joel Moore had a very nice paper in 06 where they find in closed form the corner function for those theories. There's also a log, it's also negative. But in that case, those theories are so constrained because they have so much symmetry spatially that you can have a closed form answer for all these CFTs. So C is the virial zero central charge of the parent CFT. Could be 1/2, you have Majorana, free boson is 1. And this is the angle dependence they have. So as pi, as theta goes to pi, you also have theta minus pi squared, like for CFTs. As theta goes to 0, you also have a pole, just as for CFTs. And so, yeah, it would be interesting to make a connection between the results we had for CFTs and Lifshitz theories. So for example, can you, in a smooth limit, determine its quantity in terms of the two-point function of some energy density in that Lifshitz theory? So I think there's much more to look at. It's pretty much unfetched at this point. And that's for a special class of Lifshitz theories. You can also look at more generic ones and see if things are similar. You know, you also get like 1 over theta, small theta, probably. I'm just flashing this for completeness. This is work by Rob and Pablo, where they look at not corners, but cones or hypercones in higher dimensions. So in 3 plus 1D, in the real world, you have conical entangling surfaces. And there, the smooth limit coefficient, so this thing also vanishes as theta minus pi squared as you go to cones almost being equal to pi. And there you have the same structure we found for corners and in 1 plus 1D, is that the smooth limit of this entanglement of a cone is given by the twist dimension over n minus 1. It's just this thing depends on dimension, which they have in closed form. And they did some very non-trivial checks in 3 plus 1 at least. So the same structure arises in all dimensions. And there's like an even odd structure, in fact. So all the odd CFTs, all dimensional CFTs, like 3, 5, 7, are similar, and all the even ones are also similar. And on this note, I'm going to conclude. So we looked at corner entanglement as a useful probe of quantum critical states, specifically CFTs, because they have a lot of symmetry. We looked at how this corner coefficient varies as you change the Rényi index and the angle. So here I'm plotting this smooth coefficient sigma n as a function of the Rényi index n. When n is 1, we had this CT that was proven by Tom and company. When n is very small, this spat out the full thermal entropy density of your theory. That's what I just said. In terms of a few questions that are related to the talk and that are like within reach, I believe. So we want to understand better what happens at finite angles, because that's where most of the non-trivial things are happening, for example, in the simulations. So with Pablo and Rob, Pablo and me, we looked at what happens as you look at not the first correction as you go to pi, but a second correction. So theta minus pi to the 4, there's a coefficient in front, it's sigma prime. And what is sigma prime? We couldn't exactly find what it is. It is, but we could prove that it's not equal or not determined by 2- and 3-point function data of the stress tensor. So this means it's probably 4-point data, which is very non-trivial for CFTs. So it already tells you that even if you look at the smooth limit at the next coefficient, things are already becoming quite non-trivial. So as I said, you know, we had this lower bound for the entropy as a function of angle. And the question is, what is the upper bound? I'm pretty sure there is one, because everything is very tight. So I'm conjecturing as a scalar. Can we prove that? Or can we come up with a counterexample which has entropy above that? So these seems like questions which are accessible. And I want to look at more physics for theories beyond Lifshitz, beyond CFTs. So Lifshitz, or even, for example, metals. Just take a Fermi surface. Just take a CFT, Dirac Fermion, and dope it. Can the corner entanglement tell you something about that theory? I think yes, but we don't know what the answer is. On this note, I'm going to thank you and thank my collaborators.
Okay. Is there any question or are there any questions?
very smooth, no questions almost. I got away with this.
So it's convergence all for beam for Euclidean angles. I guess you could also try to do Lorentzian angles.
Yeah. So Rob just left because he didn't answer that question. Now I'm in trouble. Damn you, Rob. So I think Horacio did some of these things actually, where he looked at what happens if your angle goes in a time direction. And I don't remember what the result is exactly, but that's one dimension where you could, because I don't think he probed this very deeply. I mean, so a short answer is that I'm not really sure, but that's something that sort of Horacio at least touched upon in his papers. Hey, Marco.
Is there any computation for weakly coupled CFT in for sigma n, like with some feature fixed points? Because it looks like everything is, if I find the proof that it looks like everything is.
Right, so that's where Max comes in. The point, so no one computed this for weakly coupled CFTs, for example, using epsilon expansion. But you could in principle because. So the point is that sigma n is hn over n minus 1. And hn is the thermal entropy density on hyperbolic space, H2.
Yeah, but the problem is that that is true or not for n. That is
good. Oh, it's true for sure.
Yeah, I would like
to. So if you compute this, you could probably check this conjecture. Even, for example, if you think the ON model when n is infinite, it's essentially free theory, which is non-trivial because you have this scale which has an anonymous dimension. And for that theory, it's not known what Hn is. Okay? So that's the starting point. It's essentially a free theory where you can compute, presumably, this twist dimension versus Rennie index. And the claim is that it'll be different because when n goes to 0, this is the thermal entropy density. And we know for the ON CFT when n is infinite that it has a different thermal entropy density than n free bosons. But no one computed this quantity for anything else than what I showed you, essentially. So it'd be good to look at this with epsilon expansion and large n for Wilson-Fisher fixed points or Grosnever or anything really, even holography, where it's also not known. Right? This we don't have. This we have, but not this. So we can't check it. Max?
Yeah, there are some indications that sometimes this quantities have a phase transition as a function of the Rini index, or maybe better put that you can have different types of conical defect boundary conditions. But I guess in your formula, then both just the right hand and the left hand are determined by, like you would have a jump in both the left hand side and the right.
Well, I guess it could break down if it's not true also. I mean, if this is true, then yeah, you'd expect both quantities to have the same behavior. But this we know what physically it is, right? I mean, this is, as I said, it's the thermal entropy density on hyperbolic space, H2. So I'm not sure if this has any anomalous behavior as you vary n. You might be able to argue that it's actually regular.
How do you define the boundary conditions in this hyperbolic space?
So that's a theory-dependent question. But for like free scalar, maybe, well, I guess you know the answer for that, the free scalar, but for generic CFTs, I'm not sure if there's any issues with boundary conditions.
I think it's kind of like edge boundary behavior. So you can have kind of different boundary conditions for generic CFTs. I think it's probably true also for this Rini entropy. With index away from 1, probably at 1
is probably fixed, right?
Yeah,
so 1, the proof by Faulkner fixes that.
Yeah, so that's the question, is there a universal to its defect? Whose definition is theory independent? Perhaps not.
Well, in your paper, Marco, was there an ambiguity
there
with
is,
the
there
defect
is
operator?
Integral construction, you would imagine that you can just take the end copy and then do that. And that would give you something which is theory independent because I just said it. If you don't have an integral, I don't know.
I mean, I think that this.
So for integer n, I think this is a well-defined procedure.
Yeah, of course, this is only, I don't know what happens for a non-integer n.
Yeah, so that's what where you could have a jump when n is continuous. But for integer n, I think.
For integer n, right? Because ultimately there is a singularity, right? So some curve distance physics will tell it.
I mean, if you take them in terms of hyperbolic space, if I attempt to show perhaps.
Yes, regular.
It's more clear that there is a universal definition because
presumably
the boundary conditions you pick in ABS do not depend on the size of your circle. They should be kind of a local.
Yeah, no, they should
not.
I mean, the answer is infinite. You regulate and you get to find an answer. I'm not sure what the answer is to how well behaved it is with n, because we don't have this quantity for essentially nothing besides the free theories.
Okay, so let's thank Will for his talk.